0550771, and the other numbers, United States versus Spurt, Graybor Medical, and Gonzalez. Before we get started on Spur, let me just ask Appellant's counsel if they've figured out how they're going to allocate the time.
We're very even-minded, Your Honor. We're going to divide it evenly if that's agreeable with the court.
Sure. Just keep an eye on the clock, would you please?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
If you keep an eye on the clock, we appreciate it if you're going to divide up your time equally.
Oh, it's not going to be divided individually. I should just watch that for the global.
You guys get a total of 20 minutes, and you can spend it however you like.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll try to use my math skills.
Okay.
May it please the Court, Donald Ray representing Appellant Boris Spurt. Your Honors, I would like to start with a discussion of the issue concerning multiple transports, which are the charges in counts 5 through 11 substantively, and it is also incorporated into the conspiracy charge. The multiple transport issue has to do with the fact that the counts 5 through 11 reflect the transfer of four patients on one day and three patients on another day in the same ambulance, and the rates were not prorated, or the passages were not prorated. The issue that comes up arises because at the time of the return of the indictment, the government referred to, and in fact it's incorporated in the indictment in paragraph 11, a federal regulation which indicated that if there are multiple patients being transported, there had to be a proration of the transports, which was different from the Medi-Cal regulation, which the defendant said he was following, which allowed these kinds of transports under other conditions. The problem that arose was that the indictment referred to this, the government referred to this regulation, but it became clear during the course of trial that that regulation was not adopted.
Offered to strike it.
They did offer to strike it.
And you declined.
And the problem with that is that once that indictment had been returned by the grand jury, it's not the defendant's job to change an indictment. It's not the government's job to change an indictment. It's the grand jury's job to change the indictment. And so what had happened here was the government went to the grand jury and got a slam-dunk indictment because these charges were not prorated. The regulation required proration. What they did then in the middle of trial is rather than try to prove that this was a violation of regulation, which is like a violation of law, they switched to basically this being a violation of some sort of insurance company policy. Now, the effect of that with regard to those substantive counts is that it's not just a change in theory, it's actually a change in charge. And we've cited the various cases which talk about a constructive amendment of the indictment, and that's effectively what occurred here. And by looking at it from the perspective of what was presented to the grand jury to obtain the charge, and what was presented to the petit jury to allow them to return a conviction on these charges, it's very clear they're two completely different offenses. So that from our perspective, once you get into the position of having a constructive amendment of the indictment, which this clearly satisfied, there's no question of prejudice or anything along those lines. Now, what the government says in response is that it's not a constructive amendment because it did not involve the term a complex of facts, which is the phraseology used in the cases to distinguish a constructive amendment from a variance. Well, this is a different complex of facts. One set of facts had to do with, as I say, a slam-dunk case. The regulation requires you to prorate. There was no proration. This set of facts had to do with nothing with regard to that. It had to do with a violation of some insurance company policy and who was aware of it and how that was communicated. So respectfully, the government's wrong on that. But even if it came down to an issue of a variance, which is what the government tries to argue, they acknowledge that the error here was an error of law. And we have cited a series of cases, including Griffin and Barona, which talk about the fact that if the petit jury was permitted to adopt a theory of prosecution which was legally incorrect as opposed to factually incorrect, that it is a fatal variance, which still requires reversal. And then the next level of review below that has to do with assuming the fact that it's only a factual variance, which this was not, it was a legal variance, was the defendant prejudiced? And it's difficult to imagine that the defendant could not have been prejudiced, because here you have a defendant who's defending a case based upon one theory of a statutory regulation, which doesn't exist, to having to defend an issue concerning notification and procedures which are occurring within an insurance company. So whichever level of review is used, it's clear that there is reversible error here. But respectfully, I think in this case, it is very clear that this is a constructive amendment of the indictment. You don't even have to get to the issue of prejudice.
What bothers me about the substantive aspect of this argument is the defendants were not actually charged with violating that regulation. It seemed to be sort of in the preamble to the charges. The actual charge was a violation of 18 U.S.C. Section 1347, and that's what they were found guilty of.
I agree with that, but the problem with that is that if one looks at what the evidence was presented before the grand jury, because the grand jury had to have gotten evidence of this regulation because they included it in the preamble, and you say, how did the grand jury return an indictment on this case? There's no doubt that the grand jury returned an indictment on the case because there was a regulation which required proration which didn't occur on these billings. So when you ask what is it that this charge was based on in front of the grand jury, the very fact that the grand jury had an indictment, had returned an indictment which referred to this regulation, which made these counts 5 through 11 absolutely violations of the law, it's clear that you, even though it's not incorporated by reference, it's part of the evidentiary basis upon which the grand jury returned an indictment. But there's a second part of this, because the prejudice flows not only from the substantive to the conspiracy count, but in vice versa. What really should have happened here, respectfully, is that the district court judge should have dismissed this conspiracy count, or at the very least, if it was not going to dismiss the entire count, should have instructed the jury that the Pinkerton instruction did not apply to counts 5 through 11. Because what you have here is a problem in which there is an invalid conspiracy count. It does specifically include the allegation regarding the regulation as a basis for there being a problem with these multiple transports. Now, we have multiple objects of the conspiracy, which is now the government's favorite tactic. But that object of the conspiracy with regard to multiple transports was legally invalid. What happens then is it's a non-existent charge. Under Pinkerton, the jury was permitted to find the defendants guilty of that conspiracy, and with regard to counts 5 through 11 of the conspiracy relating to the regulation, and then use that to shoehorn in the counts 5 through 11. That's what gets us into the Barona and Griffin argument, because there was no legally justifiable basis for finding the object of the conspiracy relating to the multiple transports, because that part of the indictment was void.
But wasn't misrepresenting how many people were transported in the ambulance for purposes of reimbursement a false statement that would violate the statute without regard to this regulation?
It's not a question of misrepresenting the number. In other words, what happened is
submitting the bill for each one individually when they were transported together.
Well, what the defendant testified to and what the facts are, for example, under Medi-Cal, if you pick them up at different locations and drop them off at different locations, you're permitted to bill, even though they're all carried by the same ambulance for portions of that trip.
That's not what was happening here.
That is what was happening here.
According to the evidence.
No, the evidence is fairly clear that the EMTs are testifying that these people were picked up at different locations and dropped off at the same location, or picked up at the same location and dropped off at different locations. That would have been a proper billing, apparently, under Medi-Cal. There is no false statement in terms of whether these people were carried. The only claim of a false statement is that there was no disclosure that there were more than one person in the ambulance, so that there is no proration. The question then becomes, why would you have to prorate? And there is no requirement that you prorate by regulation at the time that this happened. What the government fell back on is the claim that the only reason you have to prorate is that the insurance company had a policy which required you to prorate. But the regulation which required proration didn't come in for another 2 years. And that only was discovered, apparently, during the course of the trial. So I think that had this been discovered before trial, the government could have gone out and superseded the indictment. They were kind of in a pickle. I understand that, but that doesn't mean that you can violate the defendant's rights with regard to having him found guilty potentially under a conspiracy object, which was legally void.
There was one other aspect of that, though. Didn't the court find that Defendant Sherp was on notice that he was to prorate? He was on notice of the Transamerica's policy that is required to prorate.
There was evidence which, if believed by the jury, could support that contention. The problem is, when we get to a situation in which the jury's decision, which we don't know how it was based, the jury's decision could have either been based upon believing that evidence, or it could have been based upon the notion that the defendants were guilty of the conspiracy and under Pinkerton they could find them guilty of the substantive offenses. The problem is, if they took that second route, then we're in the Barona situation, because they legally could not conclude that they were guilty of the conspiracy, at least with regard to the object of the prorating of the trips. That's why I think there's a problem whether you go by looking at it at the substantive counts affecting the conspiracy or the conspiracy count affecting the substantive count. I think you get to the same point.
We're going to hear from Mr. Graybore, but the Graybore counsel.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Ray.
May it please the Court, Gilbert Chamazian for Graybore Medical Transportation, Inc., Your Honors. I previously filed a joinder in Defendant Boris Spritz's appellate brief and appeal issues, and I would join in counsel's argument. I have nothing further to add at this time. I would reserve for rebuttal.
No questions, then? Mr. Gonzalez's lawyer. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. Brian Newman on behalf of Daniel Gonzalez. Your Honor, there are two issues that I wanted to address, and one is the first one being the discovery issue and the potential Brady violation. In this particular case, Your Honor, my client post-trial went out and discovered additional evidence that had not been disclosed in two different locations, one being in Santa Ana, in a depository in Santa Ana, and the other actually being at the Graybore facility of some documents that were left over. And the document, it's funny because it's only one document, but it seems to carry the greatest weight, was this travel slip from Dr. Runyon's office, Rundle's office, where that was date stamped by a fax machine that established that, one, that the doctor was ordering ambulance transportation for certain patients, and also that this, of course, predated what Mr. Gonzalez was working at as a dispatcher for Graybore. Mr. Gonzalez, of course, is I consider him the baby of this group. He was working essentially as a lower waged employee. He did not receive anything, any benefits from the fraud. He never had any say as to the fraud, and that sort of goes into my other argument having to do with sentencing, and certainly that the sentencing certainly overstates his criminal culpability in this case.
May I ask you, where were the boxes stored during the pretrial phase? Where were the boxes located?
Well, Your Honor, that's a good question. Evidently, the government had sent certain letters out that the and I should say I was not trial counsel, that they were at the 300 building in Los Angeles, the federal building, and were being stored there. But evidently, because of the nature of the collection of the evidence and execution of the search warrants, evidently there were many, many boxes were sort of dispersed and diffused.
Were those boxes, wherever they were, examined by defense counsel?
Some boxes were evidently were obtained and
I guess what I'm getting at, if counsel doesn't look at the boxes they know about, why should we be concerned that they didn't look at the boxes they didn't know about?
Well, that certainly goes to another issue that probably would be addressed at another time and another date. But, yeah, that is certainly a concern. But But certainly Mr. Gonzalez was actively involved in his defense. And as I said, he actually went out to the depository in Santa Ana post-trial, unfortunately, and discovered a lot more evidence. I think that Mr. Gonzalez also was unfortunate that he didn't really realize the extent to which his trial counsel had not reviewed the discovery until he actually saw a copy of the trial counsel's billing, which he indicated that he had reviewed so many boxes, but that there were so many boxes left over that hadn't been reviewed, and he couldn't have been reviewed.
But the district court looked at this evidence, and didn't the district court conclude that it would not have affected the trial?
Well, I understand that, Your Honor, but I believe that the district court was in error in doing that, because certainly one of the issues is this travel slip from Dr. Rundle, which had a date stamp on it, and certainly that was one of the travel slips that my client was accused of writing out. So certainly had that one piece of document been brought before the jury with a date stamp on it that actually came from Dr. Rundle's office, may have made all the difference in the world for someone like Mr. Gonzalez, who, as I said, was a dispatcher for, I think, 7 months during the course of this situation and was making about $600 a week.
I'm not sure I follow you. Okay, so this one slip might have proven that he didn't do that particular run. There were plenty of other slips that he did do.
But there was also that was found in speaking with one of Dr. Rundle's assistants or nurses post-trial that there were other binders of Dr. Rundle's that had been taken. And none of those were, or I shouldn't say none of them, but most of those were never disclosed to the defense. And they did not have the opportunity to go through those. And I think had they had the opportunity to go through this, particularly with the patients that were
You're telling us that you still haven't been through some of this evidence?
No, we have, but we have not found all of them. All the binders that Dr. Rundle, his office staff said that were taken, to this date, Your Honor, there are still one or two that we have not been able to locate. And one of the reasons for that, Your Honor, is that the record keeping on the part of the seizing agents was so sloppy that it was almost impossible to find out what was where and when and how it was picked up and where it was picked up. But that information was brought out by an employee of Dr. Rundle's that these journals, or binders as they are called, were actually disclosed. Secondly, Your Honor, as I said, I'd like to address the issue of sentencing of Mr. Gonzalez, and I think that the district court erred in placing a higher emphasis on one or two factors of the 3553 elements, and that is the seriousness of the offense. And I can't qualm about the seriousness of the offense, but only to Mr. Gonzalez's participation in the offense, and that is his offense was extremely limited, 7 months, and he didn't benefit financially from it other than being paid as an employee of Graybar. Your Honor, at this point, I'd like to join the arguments of my counsel, and I see I have about 2 minutes, a little over 2 minutes to hold in reserve, if I may.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
May I proceed? Good morning. May it please the Court, Peggy Ryan for the United States. I would like to start by addressing some of the questions raised by Judge Wardlaw earlier. First, with respect to whether or not Defendant Spiert and Graybar and other co-defendants were placed on notice as to the requirement of notifying the number of patients who were in the van, within the ambulance, they were placed on notice. Kathy Montoya, who works for Transamerica, testified that she had a meeting with Defendant Spiert and other Graybar employees at the end of January 2000. During that meeting, she specifically advised Defendant Spiert and the others that he must indicate the number of patients and the patients' names in particular on each billing so that it could be prorated. Now, because of that...
Right. Who did she represent?
Transamerica, which is the company that was
the insurance company,
the intermediary for Medicare. Yes. So she was responsible for explaining the policies and the practices and paying out on these bills. And she let them know that this information was material to Transamerica and therefore Medicare when they review the bills and pay it out. She let them know that they would in fact be paid a lower rate per patient when there were multiple patients in the ambulance. And despite this advisement, Defendant Spiert and the other Gray Board defendants continued to act as though they could transport multiple patients at the same time and bill as though they were transported individually. And Defendant Spiert personally submitted all of those bills indicating that they were transported individually. Now, it was often the case that these patients were picked up in slightly different locations and dropped off at the same place. But it was also sometimes the case that they were all picked up at the same location and dropped off at the same location. It varied. You have to go through each of the transportation logs to figure out which was which. But it was a smattering of or a combination of those circumstances.
Okay, but why isn't it a constructive variance if in the indictment you allege the grand jury issues the indictment based on a medical regulation which is not in effect, and then later on the evidence comes in and it's based on Ms. Montoya advising Mr. Schert of this requirement?
First, I would like to point out that Defendant Spiert's counsel has not put one iota of transcript in front of the grand jury before this court. He has asked this court to speculate what happened in front of the grand jury, to assume what happened in front of the grand jury.
We know what the grand jury issued, right? We have it.
Yes, we do, Your Honor. And if we look at the charging language of the indictment, counts 5 through 11 are specifically premised on Title 18 U.S.C. 1347 and Section 2, aiding and abetting. Nowhere in counts 5 through 11 is there any reference to the regulatory violation. And the evidence presented to the grand jury was the conduct that multiple patients were transported and the bills were submitted as though they were individually transported. At this point in time, frankly, I'm not even sure if they were advised as to the law regarding the regulation. One could assume, as Mr. Ray has chosen to, that they were told as a matter of law this regulation existed. As I've pointed out, that is just akin to the Lazaro case where the government has made a misstatement of law in front of the grand jury, and that is subject to the harmless error review set forth by the Supreme Court in Menchnick, where they said, well, if the Pettit jury is given the proper instruction of law and still finds beyond a reasonable doubt that the offense is committed, that renders harmless beyond a reasonable doubt the error in front of the grand jury. So here what we have is that the charging language makes clear what the violation is. It's a statutory violation. The government's opening makes clear, I never once referenced this regulation during my opening. I referenced the offense conduct, which was the multiple transports and the billing of a single patient.
But you offered to take it out.
We did. As soon as it was raised to our attention in the middle of trial, it was inadvertence that, you know, the government hadn't looked at the indictment beforehand and caught the error. But the defense, who had equal access to these federal regulations for years, this indictment was returned, I believe, at least 2 years before the trial. They didn't attack the indictment before the trial. They raised the issue during the trial. In an effort to remedy whatever prejudice might have been raised, the government offered to strike that language. Instead, all of the defendants refused that offer, and they were very, very shrewd to have done so because they made the most of that error. They asked the court to take judicial notice of the 2002 regulation to point out to the jury that the government had made this error because they had alleged it happened.
The jury was instructed or told that this was an error?
Yes, Your Honor.
And to disregard it? Or?
No, Your Honor. In fact, I believe the government asked for that kind of instruction, and the court said, well, Your Honor, well, government, this was your error, and you're going to have to take a beating for it. And we did. It was Mr. Levine, who was trial counsel for Mr. Spiert, who during his closing argument went to great length to say that Ms. Montoya, who works for Transamerica, was not a congresswoman, she can't make the laws. Therefore, her statement, even if you believe that she put Defendant Spiert on notice, his conduct was not a crime as a matter of law because she can't create laws. He was able to use a defense that legally was incorrect because the statutory violation of health care fraud does not require regulatory violation, and yet he argued that it did, and because there was no regulation in place, that the jury should acquit Mr. Spiert on those counts. Now, the jury was not fooled because they received the proper instructions from the court in that the Title 18 U.S.C. 1347, when you read that jury instruction, did not require regulatory violation. And despite the fact that they knew of the government's error, that it was pointed out and really made the most of by the defense, they found these defendants guilty anyway. So it's clear that the error that was definitely made by the government was corrected by the Pettit, the Pettit jury's verdict. I'd also like to point out this reference to the Medi-Cal regulation is a red herring for a very simple reason. Medi-Cal is where they are two separate entities. There's Medicare and Medi-Cal, and obviously neither one is supposed to be used to regulate the other. But Medi-Cal is issuing regulations for wheelchair vans, and you can transport a number of patients in the wheelchair van, and the reimbursement rate is significantly lower. I believe it's less than $30 a patient, whereas the ambulance is several hundred dollars a patient. So whereas Medi-Cal may say, sure, you can do this and you don't have to prorate it, we're talking about maybe $30 a patient versus several hundred, and they really shouldn't be cross-referenced. There was also testimony at trial. Defendant Spear testified that he had told someone at Medicare, well, because there's no regulation, I want to use this Medi-Cal regulation. And he testified that Ms. Montoya agreed with him that that made sense. Her testimony on the rebuttal case was that, no, in fact, that never happened. She would never tell someone to use Medi-Cal. So this was an issue presented to the jury, and it was rejected by the jury. If there are no other questions on that issue, I would like to move on to the issues raised by Defendant Gonzalez.
I'm concerned on the sentencing question that we may have to defer that pending Claiborne-Rita, because it seems to me that what the errors that, you know, you're familiar with Claiborne-Rita.
I'm actually not familiar with those two particular cases. I apologize.
Well, Zavala-Cardi?
Yes.
Ring a bell?
Yes.
Okay. Well, we've deferred our ruling on Zavala-Cardi pending the Supreme Court's decision on two cases, Claiborne-Rita, which raised similar issues.
Is that the issue of whether or not a presumption should be given to the
Not just that, but how you actually, there's a number of issues. There was a briefing order in Zavala-Cardi that touches on a number of issues, including that particular one. But it goes to how you conduct reasonableness review. And I think given, and I just want to know, my feeling is tentatively, given that we're talking about whether the clear and convincing standard still applies on evidence and these particular enhancements and the application of the Section 3553 factors, that we probably have to defer ruling on that until we see how the Supreme Court is going to tell us how to factor in some of these things.
Your Honor, I think that in this particular case we can go forward with the sentencing issue. There is a longstanding case law in the Ninth Circuit that instructs us how we deal with these various issues and when it arises out of a conspiracy and when other sentencing factors ought to be given a heightened analysis for due process reasons. And I think we do have the instruction from the Ninth Circuit case law such that we could go forward today. Because most of the sentencing enhancements here really do relate to the charge of conduct, it's clear that the case law of United States versus Dare and U.S. versus Harrison have survived the Booker-Blakely.
And what about United States versus Statton?
Well, yes, Your Honor. United States versus Statton says that essentially the clear and convincing standard survives the Booker decision. But even before Booker, that was not applied to all sentencing factors. That was reserved for cases where you were really enhancing somebody's sentence based on uncharged conduct. And here we don't have that. We have a single sentencing enhancement that was not related directly to the charges in the case, and that's for obstruction. That was a two-point enhancement. But when we look at all of the other enhancements in this case, we have loss, we have the more than minimal planning, which is a specific offense characteristic, and under Johannesson we learned that that indicates that it is part of the extent of the conspiracy if it is labeled as a specific intent, specific offense characteristic. And then we have his role in the conspiracy, which it logically concludes that his role in the conspiracy for which he was convicted is part and parcel of the charged conduct that the jury found him guilty of. So I don't think we have here a case where due process is offended by the preponderance of the evidence standard. I think we have a case where the jury returned the verdict of guilty on the conspiracy as well as health care fraud, several counts of health care fraud, and the vast majority, all but two levels of enhancement came from that conduct. It's not a case where the enhancements come from uncharged conduct or relevant conduct that cannot be related to the conspiracy. So I think we can go forward. I would also like to address the discovery, allegation of the discovery violation, because I do think there's been some misrepresentations as to what happened. I was trial counsel. I know Mr. Newman was not. But it was the case that those, the fact that these documents existed was disclosed to defense counsel, and not a single one of them made any attempt to review it pretrial. There was a request that certain documents be specifically produced, and the government produced those documents. With respect to what was found after trial, despite Mr. Newman's allegation that there was a hodgepodge of documents spewed everywhere, this simply wasn't the case. There was no finding or even genuine factual showing to the district court that it was anything other than the documents were stored in two locations. And while Mr. Newman has said there are certain binders that weren't found, there wasn't sufficient credible evidence that those binders were ever seized by the government. So the district court made its finding that at the time that the discovery motion was brought pre-sentencing, he was ultimately satisfied that whatever the government had in its possession had been made available to the defense, and what was presented to him didn't, in his mind, amount to something that would change the trial verdict if a new trial were given. Also, he specifically noted that there was no allegation that a Brady violation had occurred pre-trial, and he wasn't considering that. So it really is untimely for Mr. Newman to raise that on behalf of Mr. Gonzalez at this time. I'd also point out that in Defendant Spiert's reply brief, he indicated that the issue of bed confined was really limited to a certain number of counts and a certain number of patients, and I think the factual record more than supports that that was the overarching issue in the case, that Defendant Spiert and Defendant Gonzalez and the other managers at Graybore universally told the EMTs that they must indicate bed confined on the patient's trip tickets, whether or not those patients were bed confined. So the fact that that evidence came in with so prominent trial was directly relevant to the issues before the jury, and it was not irrelevant. And that particular argument was not raised in front of the district court, so it really is on a plain error review before this court. There were other similarly, not similarly related. The one issue that was raised before the court was whether or not EMTs could testify as a matter of expert opinion that these patients did or did not need ambulance transportation. That was the one issue the district court did rule on and said that, no, the EMTs could only testify to what they observed, not what their expert opinion on was as a matter of whether or not the patients used the ambulance. So this issue really is being raised for the first time in front of the appellate court. And if the court doesn't have any further questions for the court, excuse me, for the government, I would thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Ryan. Give each of you guys a minute and a half for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll be very brief.
First, I have a great deal of respect for Ms. Ryan, and she's attempted to avoid this issue of the constructive amendment very effectively, but respectfully, I'd ask the court to consider it just from this point of view. Imagine the charge here was only a conspiracy to violate the provision regarding multiple transports, and you had just a conspiracy with that one object and then the substantive counts 5 through 11. Had that been the case, that conspiracy would have had to have been dismissed during the course of trial because its object was illegal. Had that been the case, at the very least, under this circuit's decision in United States versus Nakai, N-A-K-A-I, 413, Fed 3rd, 1019, it would have been legally impermissible to give a Pinkerton instruction. And not only would it have been legally impermissible to give the instruction under Nakai because there would have been no valid conspiracy count, it would have been a violation of Barona because the conspiracy count would have been illegal. So however one looks at it, we still get back to the fact that those counts are potentially illegally returned. Secondly, counsel has brought up the bed confined issue. I haven't had a chance to address that. I have addressed it in the brief, and I'd ask the court to review that. But clearly, the evidence we are complaining about is evidence that 25% to 75% supposedly of these patients were ambulatory. Just because they're ambulatory doesn't mean that they can't be transported by ambulance. There are other reasons why they can be transported by ambulance, and they never tied any of those allegations to specific claims that these people were billed in that fashion. And finally, just very quickly, I wasn't trial counsel, but I came in as the one who was running around looking at all these boxes. We did ask to join in that portion of the argument. I would just indicate to the court, I believe that the record reflects that while the trial counsel did not review the boxes, that an investigator for the trial counsel went down and reviewed the boxes that were available, but was unaware of the fact that these other boxes that were in Santa Ana even existed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ray.
Mr. Dawson.
Mr. Tamazian.
Thank you, Your Honors. Gilbert Tamazian for Government Medical Transportation. One important factor here, I believe that from what I remember, because I was at trial myself, in that the documents that the binders that was in question regarding from Dr. Rundle's office was became important at the time that wasn't disclosed to the defense was because of the fact that it would show the medical necessity forms of each patient that was transported by Graber Medical Transportation, Inc., which would mean that that document was in possession of Dr. Rundle, which allowed Graber to make that transportation. That is one issue that became very important with respect to the discovery issue and documents from Dr. Rundle's office. I wanted to point that out to the court, and that was the center of the discussion when the issue came up. Second, I want to add one thing to regards to this regulation. The testimony by Ms. Montoya was not clear as to exactly what the requirement from the ambulance company was based on Medicare billing. For example, there was no testimony which indicated that ambulance transport of the same patient from two patients or three patients from one location to the same location should be treated differently than if the patients were picked up from one location and transported to three different locations. There was no testimony regarding that or any testimony that Graber or anybody else was given such instructions, whereas at the time, Medi-Cal had that regulation which indicated that the ambulance company picking up patients from the same location and transferring to different locations can bill individually. That's all.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Newman?
Thank you, Your Honors. Brian Newman for Mr. Gonzalez. Your Honor, the disproportionate manner in which the court viewed the 3553 factors by giving the greatest weight to the seriousness of the offense versus vis-a-vis other remedies, other sentences, certainly caused a great deal of concern. It should be considered also the fact that Mr. Gonzalez got a sentence about 60% of that of Mr. Spurt, who, of course, ran the company. Also, Your Honor, to have Mr. Gonzalez designated for a three-level enhancement as a leader manager is sort of disingenuous in that Mr. Spurt was the one who ran this company. Mr. Gonzalez had no authority to change or alter any of the requirements set forth by Mr. Spurt and could not do so. And, in fact, the evidence was that Mr. Spurt had meetings with all the EMTs, all the other employees, telling them exactly what they had to do, and that Mr. Gonzalez did not have the authority to alter that in any manner, shape, or form. So based on that, Your Honor, I would submit on my briefs.
Thank you, Mr. Newman. Thank you. Gentlemen, thank you. Ms. Ryan, thank you as well. The case just argued is submitted. We'll stand in recess for the morning.